Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Hi, I'm Chanti.
And I'm Lynx, and you're listening to Muses.
Enjoy the show. We are so excited to share our interview with the magnificent Miriam Lina. Miriam has been making her mark on the music world since 1976. She was the first drummer of the legendary band The Cramps before meeting her partner, Billy Miller.
Together, her and Billy took their passion for music to the next level. First came their fanzine Kicks, then came Norton Records, which focuses on amazing rockabilly and garage reissues from the 50s to the 70s. And if that weren't enough, Miriam's love of literature then led to the formation of Kick Books, their publishing company.
I really loved this conversation so much. Every time we chat with somebody at the end, I'm always like, that was my favorite interview ever. And honestly, this was like the same thing. I was so energized after we had this conversation with Miriam. And I really think that people are going to learn a lot from this episode. And I think they're really going to enjoy it.
I agree.
Miriam talks with us about all this and Kick Books' latest masterpiece, Mind Over Matter, The Myths and Mysteries of Detroit's Fortune Records, written by Michael Hurt and Billy Miller himself. Head over to NortonRecords.com to purchase your copy of the book, and while you're at it, pick up the Rockin' Vinyl too. Enjoy the interview. Well, Miriam, you and I have something in common. I grew up in Sudbury, Ontario.
No way, no way. Really?
I did, yes. Actually, a small town outside of Sudbury called Naughton.
I know Naughton. Mm-hmm. I know Naughton. It's kind of like Norton. But I left when I was quite young. I left when I just turned 11 years old. Mm-hmm. So, but I have a lot of memories. Of course, all of those early memories. And I missed Canada so much all through, you know, my teen years and stuff like that. I missed my friends. And I just wish that I could have never left there, to be perfectly honest. Now I've been gone for many decades, but I'm still a Canadian at heart and still a Canadian citizen, believe it or not.
Awesome. Well, I think by the time I was 11, I did know that I did want to leave Sudbury sooner rather than later.
I didn't, you know, I didn't know that any world existed outside of it, you know, and at that time in 1967, which is when we left, you probably know Sudbury was a really different place. I went back for the first time in almost 50 years. Was it 50 years? Yeah. With my brother, my older brother. He's 9 years older than I. And we came up there because some friends who were in a band called the Fleshtones, New York band, who are popular in Canada, they were doing a gig up there. And it was immediately immediately after Billy's passing, and they thought that it would be a good idea to be with friends and go travel a little because I hadn't traveled for quite some time. And so I went up there and I met my brother, and we went to all the old spots, the old school, the old house, you know, all of this stuff to try to reconnect with it. And it was bittersweet, but I knew that I was no longer a Sudburyan at that point, you know, and sort of my brother, you know. So it was great to go back and kind of look at the roots and experience it, and a lot of beautiful things. The lake, you know, we used to have a cabin by the lake. That was great. But in in total, it was, it you know, life takes you where it takes you. And when you're a child, you go where your family takes you.
That's for sure. Yeah. I'm proud of how Sudbury has really grown over the last few years into a really strong music and arts community.
Yes.
Indeed. I didn't feel much of that too much when I was in high school, but it's really come a long way. And now I can say I'm feeling proud of Sudbury these days. But
yeah,
why don't you tell us about after you left your upbringing a little bit, and where did your passion for music begin?
Well, I was born in Sudbury to a family that were immigrants from Finland. And so my brother and sister were both born there, and so were my parents. So I grew up in a primarily Finnish community, spoke Finnish first and so on, and went to a Finnish church and so on. My neighbors were Ukrainian. They went through exactly the same thing, except, so they were Ukrainian, and they went through their whole thing, but we were friends, you know, and English was our common language. So it was a unique kind of a thing. My father worked at INCO, of course, like
of course.
What 90% of the population.
So did my grandfather.
Yeah. So that's how it was. And when we left, it was in the middle of sixth grade, and it was a big deal to me. In Canada, you know, I'd gone through my older brother and sister, especially the British invasion, and radio was really, really big. CHUM 1050 Toronto, and listening at night to CKLW from Detroit coming across the water, and CKSO in Sudbury, and so on. You know, radio was really the thing, more than TV. I think radio was the thing, and that was the connection. We trying to figure out what the words were. I remember on the playground when the Beatles came out, I remember we were pretending we were riding horses, saying, "And then while I'm away, I'll ride home every day." We thought the lyrics were "ride home." You know, it's like, wow, the Beatles ride horses. but it was a unique time. I mean, I was really, I was a Canadian kid. That's all I knew. I remember when JFK was assassinated, when Kennedy was assassinated, and we were all sent home from school in Canada, Churchill Public School. That's where I went. And they sent the little kids home first. And I believe I was in kindergarten at that time. And they sent us home. And my sister's 6 years older than me. She said that they were watching the little kids go, and everybody was really distraught. You know, this was a huge tragedy. And I was overheard saying to my little friend, amidst many sobs, "They're going to come up here and kill the queen." Because we had the queen on the, you know, it was on always prominent, you know, right there by the blackboard, you know, the flag and the queen. And she was so beautiful and all of this. Like, she came to Sudbury at that time. I don't remember that, but it was a big, deal. I was really Anglified, and with the British invasion, my sister and brother, cool mods, you know, at the time, 65, 64, 65, they were the hipsters. And I was the little kid, you know, just watching and listening to this great thing happen. And that was the point in January of 67 when we came, and things changed a lot. American life for a school kid was very different. It was much more mature and much more rowdy and crazy, and, you know, not all this raising your hand and saying please and thank you in the very polite way that school was for young kids in Canada. It was very different. I was threatened the day, first day I came back to school. You know, they're like, "We don't look like you over here." You know, and I had the long pigtails, and I went to school January with my red stretch pants and my white go-go boots, you know, and I didn't know you couldn't wear pants to school. You know, at that time, you know, we could wear slacks because the snow was, you know, up to our necks. So you didn't have to wear a skirt to school, but I learned that really fast. And it was pretty brutal that first year, and kind of sided with what eventually became a real rock and roll crowd, which has always been kind of a little bit of an outsider type of a deal, especially when you're a teenager and growing up, you don't quite fit in. I was younger than kids in my class and so on, but I'm glad it happened the way that it did.
Wow. Yeah. So you moved to Cleveland. When did you first start going out to shows? And I know the Dead Boys are from there. You knew Stiv. I love them so much.
Yeah, great guys.
What brought you into that scene?
Well, actually, we lived in a really small town about 50 miles away from Cleveland, right on the lake. So 50 miles at a time when you're like, you know, you're in your early teens, a 12-year-old, and so on. I was in high school between the ages of 12 and 16. During that time, I mean, going 50 miles was like going across country. It was very difficult. But again, radio played in really big time. And Cleveland radio at the time was early FM radio, WNCR, and then it turned into WMMS, which is a huge station. And CKLW still with the AM was coming in big time. I mean, that's such a huge station that we got it in Northern Ontario and all through Ohio, and it was really influential. But I didn't really start going into Cleveland until probably, I remember my first show that I went to was a open festival, because I was young enough to be able to go, and I went with my sister, and that was really exciting. Cleveland seemed like a really big town at that time. Of course, now it doesn't seem so big, but at the time it was like, oh, like Paris, Rome, London, Cleveland. But at any rate, one thing that did happen is my brother belonged to a fraternity, and the fraternity brought in acts into this small town, Ashtabula, Ohio. Jack Kerouac wrote about it. It's been mentioned in a couple of places as being like a really small town that people passed through, and it was really scenic at one time. Kind of a resort town where people from the central states would come there, and they'd be right on Lake Erie. And Lake Erie at one point in time was not so polluted as it was when we were there. But in the early days, it was a very scenic, beautiful kind of a little town. But at any rate, my brother's fraternity brought in, at one point when I was still in high school, probably 15, he brought in the Amboy Dukes, you know, Journey to the Center of the Mind, hey, this Detroit band, you know, he brought them in with a fraternity flag behind the stage and all this stuff. And he had asked me to help set up chairs there, you know, as though the chairs would last very long with the rock and roll show. So folding chairs, and I'm like setting them up. But that was a mind blower for me. I mean, seeing them in a gym, to see the Amboy Dukes, Ted Nugent, the guys, you know, like on stage, you know, it was so loud and so amazing that seeing that in person was really, you know, I've thought about this many times, that what was the show that really did it, you know, and I like to think it was the Stooges, you know, it's like, or Slade or Bowie or some one of the big acts that ended up coming to Cleveland. But it was actually, I really think it was the Amboy Dukes in Ashtabula, who just like completely blew the roof off of the place, scared everybody to death, and really kind of amazed me and my sister who were there. And of course, my brother was, you know, the muscle moving the amps around. And I thought, wow, my brother's like, he's rock and roll.
I love that. It's always just such a magical experience when you first enter that world and, you know, find your place in it and realize like, I found my people.
Yeah. That's so cool. You got to experience that with your brother and your sister as well. My brother was in a band early on, and
that got
me interested for sure.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
So you started going to these shows. At what point did you start going into New York and getting into that scene?
Oh, I just found a photo of that first trip to New York. What happened was, I started at Kent State in 71, and I graduated. This sounds so long ago. I can't believe it. It's like another century. Oh my God, did I say that? In 73, I was 17, and my sister and I went to England. My sister just turned up at home. She was already, she was graduating from college. I was a year out of high school and had started college, and she said, we're going to England. And my mother was like, you're not taking Miriam anywhere. She's like, well, I got two tickets. They're one-way tickets. We're going. And, and my mother acquiesced and so on. We just went. We went penniless. We went to England in June of 73 and just spent several months crisscrossing the country, went into Ireland and Scotland and so on, hitchhiking with like no money and wanting to see the rock and roll that was going on at that time. And as you know, in many of those years, but 73 was a really spectacular year. We had already been hanging out with a lot of groups, just having fun and going to the shows and getting our minds blown by the fact that there was another alternate universe out there that wasn't quite so boring and you didn't have to sit around for 3 weeks waiting for something exciting to happen, you know. So England was a really major turning point for me. And when I came back, I ended up finishing school, graduated from Kent State. But before that is when I really became heavy duty friends with people in Cleveland, because Kent, Ohio and Cleveland, Ohio, again, are not that far apart. And it wasn't a big deal to be able to go to shows. And I had discovered a group in Cleveland called Rocket from the Tombs and became close friends with their leader, two leaders, actually, Peter Loeffner and Crocus Behemoth. And became close friends. They would come individually to come visit me in Kent, and I would go to the shows and see them. I thought they were absolutely great. They became Pere Ubu, and at that same time, I became friends with Steve Bators, who at the time was groupless, then was in a group called Frankenstein, and then the Dead Boys. And you probably saw on my blog that on my Kicksville 66 blog, that Steve and I were really, really close friends. I mean, he gave me my first job when I was out of Kent, really desperate for money. I made phone calls with him to try to collect money for a fireman's fund. I was unsuccessful. He could sell anything to anybody. He was just pick up the phone and say, how are you? And they were like, how much you want? It was very persuasive. But at any rate, it's coming up now, an anniversary, because November 1st was the first date that the Cramps played, and that was with the Dead Boys. And it was the Dead Boys' first appearance in New York. And there's a letter from Steve on my website where he said, hey, guess who we're playing with? You. It's like, oh boy. And we had never played, and the group wasn't even listed as the Cramps. It was listed as like opening act or something like, or something ridiculous like that. But that was, that was a really early moment. The Cramps thing happened on a visit that my sister and I made to New York in 74 or 75. And we ran into Lux and Ivy, who I didn't know, but vaguely recognized. They recognized us from Cleveland. And we were in New York. We were at a hamburger restaurant. And they came over and said, hey, aren't you girls from Ohio? So, yeah. I was like, well, we are too. We're moving to New York. So, great. And they were moving from Akron, which is even closer to Kent. It's really like the sister city almost. And so they said, look, when we come, how about if we stop by? Yeah, okay, fine. Not thinking that that would ever happen, but they did. They turned up at my door one day, and they had plans for a group, and they started telling me about this thing, and ended up getting asked to join a group. I had never played drums. I never had any aspirations ever to actually be active in music. You know, I always thought that I was, going to somehow end up doing something on the writer end of things, because I was crazy about books and crazy about reading magazines and books and doing research. I was kind of a goofball in that regard, but I never thought I would play in a group. And that's really when it happened. I ended up being in the Cramps for a full year. And then after that, the whole generational thing of, okay, go to another band and then stay for a long time. And then life happened. And you could ask me about that. Cause it's
amazing. Lynx has actually done an episode on Lux and Ivy, and she's the one that introduced me to the Cramps. And
okay.
I don't want to skip by anything. Lynx, is there anything you want to dig in there before we move on?
It's just so phenomenal to me because you lived in like the era in New York that I admire so much. The fact that both like the Cramps and the Dead Boys are playing their first show together.
Yeah.
Like that's just mind blowing and like magical, and like what a scene to be a part of. It just must have been incredible. Well, and there's so many other artists too at the time.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And the thing is that it was really a small scene. I mean, there were the more popular groups, of course, the Ramones, who were the main reason that anybody would want to be in New York. I mean, they were just, you don't want to call them the darlings. They were just, they didn't try to be special. They didn't try to act like they were better than anybody else. They were just fantastic friends. And with the Cramps, we played many dates with them, many opening shows for them. And I was dear friends with them. And they were just excellent human beings. And that was the whole representation of New York for me. It wasn't what became New Wave. And it really wasn't what the Cramps became after I left. I mean, they got their whole deal immediately afterward. I mean, I was shocked, you know, when I was, you know, like I saw a picture of him and I thought, oh, what the hell's going on here? You know, it's very weird. But they built that whole fantasy into what became them. And I admired them for that. And that's a really good thing. It was good for me to not be in the group after that, because there's no way that I would have fit in. There's just no way. I'm not theatrical. You know, I don't primarily like to, wear scanty clothing and get on stage. You know, that's just not my bag. So it was good when that all happened, and everybody stayed involved in music. You know, they got very involved with building this entire fan base and with a revolving door of drummers and additional guitar players, some that stayed longer, some that didn't. I've seen the family tree and it's quite long. And, you know, that's something else. I never saw the Cramps ever. Of course, I didn't see them when I was in the group. And afterward, I didn't see them until Ivy's 50th birthday. Wow. And they played in New York at the Warsaw. And I got a message through someone saying, oh, they're inviting you and Billy to come in to the show. And we did. And we saw each other for the first time in a very long time. Very long time. And it was good. And then I never saw Lux again because he passed away subsequently.
That's amazing that you got to see them one last time, especially.
I think so too.
Lux Pat, that was meant to be for sure.
That was meant to be for sure.
This week's episode is brought to you by Best Fiends. Best Fiends has challenging puzzles, but it's a casual game anyone can play.
Guess what, Shanti?
What?
This week I hit level 300.
Woohoo!
I was really loving all of the fun Halloween-related graphics and events, and I just kept going and going. They really always keep it fresh with these new engaging material.
Well, congratulations. I'm still a little bit ahead of you. I'm on level 365, and I also noticed those really cute Halloween graphics.
Yeah, they were fun. I took your great tip from last time, and I made sure to keep switching out all of my collectible characters to get past some of those really challenging levels.
Yeah, and I'm excited to see what keeps changing as we get into November and to Christmas and see what.
Oh, yeah, you know, there'll be good stuff.
No Wi-Fi? No problem. I was off the grid visiting my mom this past weekend, but I was still able to get in my daily game time because the internet is not required to play. You can still have fun anytime, anywhere.
Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play.
Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Hi, I'm Jenny Owen Youngs.
And I'm Kristen Russo.
And together, we run Buffering, a rewatch adventure. a family of podcasts moving through our favorite 90s genre television. We talk about iconic shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The X-Files, and even some current TV like Yellowjackets.
Buffering has been praised in places like Time, Esquire, Paste Magazine, and The New York Times, and we've chatted with dozens of cast members, writers, directors, and fans along the way. Come hang out and rewatch some of your favorite television with us and a wonderful community of listeners.
Learn more at BufferingCast.com or find us on socials at BufferingCast.
Speaking of Billy, how did you meet Billy? Tell us all about that. Was it love at first sight? Like, what?
Well, I tried to think about that because you posed that question on the email, and Billy loved to tell the story that's not how it happened, and I was like, really, because I met him. I know the date that a big record fair was going on in New York. It was what was it called? The Rock Ages record fair, and people were bringing records from their home and from their collections and selling. And I went with a friend, October 3rd, 1977. And I was looking for a particular record, and in going around table to table looking for it, Billy was one of the people, and he saw, he recognized me from, he had seen the Cramps before, and he had also been a reader of a fanzine that I did, which was the Flamin' Groovies Monthly. And he had picked that up at a record store, and he goes, "Oh, you're the Flamin' Groovies girl." I'm like, "Yeah, you know." And he's, I asked him about the record, and he said, "Oh no, I have that record at home though, you know." And I thought, well, a lot of good that's going to do me. So he did invite me to come and visit him. And I went with a friend, a younger friend, who's still a very, very close friend, a guy who said, like, "I'm going with you," you know, and he did. And we went, and, this guy's got a lot of records. He's really nice and all this stuff. And it did happen pretty quickly after that. He says that we had met at a midnight movie some months earlier. I was there with Brian Gregory. It was some horror movie. And he said that he sat down with his friend behind us and then realized that we were sitting in front of him, and tapped Brian on the shoulder and said, "Oh, hey, you know, I saw your band." And Brian went to introduce me. And I was reading a book, and kind of barely noticed him. And Billy said, he thought, "What kind of a girl is this? Reading a book at a movie? You know, this is crazy." But he learned to live with that. I do a lot of reading, and books became, really part of my so-called career at one point in time. And it's always been important. So it wasn't love at first sight, but it was a very, very, very serious and loving lifetime that I spent with him. 38 years.
Yep. That's so special. And you guys not only have this personal relationship, but a working one. You've done so much together.
Yeah.
What came first? Was it the zine?
Yes. What had happened was, I was doing a fanzine that was focused on the Flamin' Groovies because I was a huge fan, and it was called the Flamin' Groovies Monthly. And then when I met Billy, he was saying, "Well, you're doing a fanzine. I got to do a fanzine." I said, "Yeah, yeah. What do you want to do it on?" And he said, "Well, I love the Raiders, Paul Revere and the Raiders." And that's where this title came from, Kix, because Kix keep getting harder to find, It's a Raiders song. So, it went almost immediately from that idea of being just a Raiders magazine to being an all-encompassing kind of thing. He said, "I'll write about the Raiders. You write about the Groovies. We'll get our friends to write about what they want to write about. We'll do record reviews and all this stuff." And in the spring of 79, we came out with Kix number one, never intending for there being forever having a Kix number two. But as it were, we did well with that. Not that it was selling like gigantic quantities or anything, but by well with that, I meant that we made connections with other like-minded people all around the world. And it was those Kix people, those initial people that I'm still closest friends with, so those friendships that were made in the 70s really lasted. And that says something for our music, for rock and roll, that friendships built on rock and roll are lasting friendships. It's not something that just is a teenage fancy and you're get over it. We all love this stuff.
We noticed that on the Norton Records site that they're all sold out. Will any reissues be coming available?
Someone else did a reprinting of Kix number one when Hurricane Sandy hit. Cause I don't know if you know about that, but we were really destroyed by Hurricane Sandy. We lost 250,000 records in Red Hook, had to completely evacuate and move away from our warehouse there. And during that time, like, we had a lot of people, a lot of well-wishers and people who thought up like genius ideas of what to do to make sure that the label didn't go under, you know, because we went underwater, but, you know, we managed to build up after that. But they reprinted number one. I'm actually working on a new issue 28 years after the last issue. After the book came out, I was like, you know, I had been floundering about the idea about what's going to happen after that. You know, it's like, I was almost afraid during this period of 4 years of putting the book together and getting it published, that what was going to happen. And about a year ago, I mentioned doing a new issue of Kix to Mark Miller, who is the guy that I do the Crash and the Party radio show with and started the Waterloo Underground show with, which is all Kinks related, but Crash and the Party is all doo-wop, and that's really my main musical interest at this point in time, and has been for quite a long time. So I mentioned that to him. He goes, "Yeah, we got to do it. That, you know, like, all right." And I asked him if he would co-edit with me, and he said yes. So we're going to do a new issue, and it's really pretty well on the way, at least with the main story ideas and so on. There's still a lot of work to be done. But, you know, never say never. People didn't think that there was going to be anything after Kix number seven. But as I said, it's 28 years later, and there's a new issue underway. And I hope that it delivers the same kind of humor and also information that hasn't never been divulged, and interviews with some of these people who made records that haven't been found before. That was always the deal with Kix, is trying to tell untold stories and be enthusiastic about it and behave the way that we felt that these people were as important as the big stars out there who actually made records on major labels. You know, we wanted to shine a light on the records that we really cared about, and that continues to be the case for a new volume of Kix. And whether there will be anything after Kix number eight, it's the same never say never that it was after Kix number one and two and three and four.
Yeah. I'm glad that you explained that, because maybe some of our listeners haven't really read many zines or any at all. And so it's good to know that this is what they could have expected from if they would have picked one up.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and
you were doing.
Yeah. And the print format is just so special to me. I always think of printed word, even without images to look at, that the printed word is such magic. You know, it's music you hear with your ears, and you cobble up the emotion and the feeling and the storyline in your mind, and it's different for just about everybody. You know, it's a way of interpreting, and watching movies and TV, it's a little bit more designed into you understanding the way someone else wants to portray it. But a book, the whole miracle of like letters on a page, on paper, you know, not on a screen, but on paper, and something that you could touch and cover and select and flip the pages and you're in control of completely, that can cause you to emote in any kind of way. It can make you angry, happy, sad, et cetera, et cetera. call to action, you know, and it's portable. It's something that you can, well, maybe not with the new Mind Over Matter book, because it's 5 pounds.
It's quite big.
You need a backpack or a mule to carry that thing around. But anyway, that's the story with that.
Literature is definitely one of the most magical things.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the few outlets that you use your imagination with, right? It's not like someone else completely painting the picture. You have
exactly
to fill it in as well. It's
right.
You're a participant.
Right. You are. And I collect, I have a pretty huge collection of paperbacks. That was really my real passion in collecting. I felt that this was literature for everyone. You know, it was inexpensive. It was disposable, unfortunately. So a lot of the stuff is rare to find. But the whole idea of portable hip pocket paperbacks was really where it was at for me. And I started writing about them in Kix, you know, Billy, said, okay, yeah, you write about paperbacks. He was really not a book fiend as in any kind of a way that I was, but he was very tolerant and supportive of it. And it was out of that story about paperbacks, about juvenile delinquent paperbacks particularly, that led to me doing another magazine called Bad Seed. And from Bad Seed came what evolved into being Kicks Books. Kicks Books may have the word kicks in it. And of course, like all of that writing and joy that Kicks was about, when Kicks Books came about, it was more out of Bad Seed, which was strictly about paperbacks, juvenile delinquent paperbacks. And that's where it came from. I originally was going to call it Kickstand to be able to borrow from the Kicks magazine name and also from Nightstand Books, which was edited at one point by one of my favorite writers, Harlan Ellison. So that's where that came from 10 years ago. So there's a lot of things that have happened in the interim, a lot of written and musical things. But, you know, Norton Records became the big thing in 1986. And the label is what actually caused the magazine to take a 28-year hiatus, because people wanted to hear what the record sounded like, you know, that we were writing about. If we wrote about Hazel Adkins, you know, what did he sound like? And so we hunted down Hazel and brought him to New York and issued a record again with only one intention, just compile a record so that people can understand what he sounds like, never intending for there to be a second Norton album. And we named the label after Ed Norton of the Honeymooners, because they were in Brooklyn and, you know, perfect. It's a two cool couples, you know. So at any rate, that was that's where it came from, and that really took over from Hazel Adkins to Escarita, you know, to the Rockin' R's, to Link Wray, several volumes of Link Wray, and now it's well over 200 albums and CDs and 45s later, and here we are with the new issue of Kicks underway. And Billy's masterwork, which was Mind Over Matter, out in as posh and fabulous a manner that I could possibly make for him. Because I really believe that even with all the stuff that he did, all the great writing, research, he was a great friend, such a great band member, a supporter of so many different people. He was a really unbelievable individual. Even with that, I honestly believe that this was, you know, and I don't use the word casually, I think it was his masterpiece. He worked so long on something that he really, really believed in. And of course, the love of collecting records and trying to divulge these secrets behind names that he didn't know. At one point, he was saying that all of the people on the Fortune label had such intriguing names, Nathaniel and Andre and Nolan Strong and all of these names that they had like an air of majesty to them, you know. And we ended up knowing many of them, of course, not Nolan because he was long gone, but Andre Williams, Nathaniel Mayer, so many of them that ended up coming into our life and actually recording for us on Norton. So that was so incredible for him. And then, you know, just he worked on it until his last day on this planet. He truly did. He had a very serious illness. And, you know, nobody in the world could have been working on a book as long as he did. There's no doubt about that. And everybody knows that, but he did. And he wanted that book out and he wanted it published by Kicks Books. And at one point I was telling him, I said, like, you know, Billy, you know, maybe it would be better to go to another publisher with it, someone who did hardcover books, because I had never done one. And he said, no, this is going to be a Kicks book, as though he already knew that something was that there was a possibility of not surviving the point where the book could actually make an appearance. So I took it upon myself to make sure that it became fabulous. And his co-author, Michael Hurt, a brilliant guy, great historian, very heartfelt fellow. He really, really filled in a lot of stuff and worked with a lot of things after Billy's passing, and of course during it too. And we had a great designer, woman designer, Elizabeth Van Italy, who was very patient with putting together a book that was almost 600 pages. And, you know, I think she was delighted to be able to work on a book that, you know, I told her it's going to be full color. She's like, full color, you know, it's like, that's amazing. You know, do you have that many full color pictures? Is that we got record labels, and that's the main thing that Billy, you know, more important than a person's face, really. I mean, you know, I'm just kidding, but more important than that was this, the mystery and the mystique of a Fortune Records label. Mm-hmm. They kept this very, very old world look to their labels that really belonged on something like Vocalion or some kind of a blues label, Fortune Records. And the detail that was on the records often was the only information that he had to go by to try to track down, you know, who wrote it, where was it recorded, what was the deal, and so on. And fortunately, sorry, bad choice of words. luckily, we did get to go to the Fortune building when it was already deserted and abandoned, but we did get to go there before they tore it down. And just to be, you know, in the magic of the building, because that was also another thing that I still believe in and that we totally felt was going to the location where something happens, even though it's decades later or 100 years later, you know, go to some famous castle or whatever. We felt the same way about these places where records were recorded or where somebody lived. Yeah.
Sure. We got to record once at Sun Studio and it was like,
oh my goodness, yeah. That is magical. What do you mean you got to record there? Do you have a band?
Well, no, we did a podcast episode. We just happened to go for a tour and we met the guys that worked there and we told them about our podcast and they were like, why don't you come back tonight and we'll record? And it was just,
wow.
You're like sitting right there where like Elvis recorded and
yeah, exactly.
Jerry Lee and like all these people is, oh, yeah. You feel the energy.
Yeah. Yeah. You do. I believe that. I believe that it retains itself because it's music. Yes. And music is something that is from the spheres and it's a beautiful thing. It's an amazing thing. It's not a pastime and it's not entertainment per se, it's something much deeper and much more incredible, something that makes our hearts beat.
We're going to take a quick pause in our show to tell you about Usual Wines. Usual Wines are wines for the modern drinker, aka me, and maybe you too. Each bottle is 6.3 ounces, which is a heavy pour or about a glass and a half of wine. So no more pouring wine down the sink when you don't want to finish the bottle. You know what else I've done? Don't tell anyone. I've poured wine from my glass back into the bottle when I couldn't finish it. But not anymore. Because of the single serve format and bottle design, Usual is always fresh, no more flat, bubbly, or stale rosé. Usual has a red blend, a rosé, and a sparkling white wine called Brut. The wines are low carb and have 0 grams of sugar. My favorite was the white, which was surprising because I'm usually a red drinker. I could taste the elderflower and it really smelled lovely, like bergamot. It's refreshing and not too sweet, not too sour or too crisp, and there's a really good balance. I was thinking maybe the lemon would make it too citrusy, but I think it really evens it out and actually gives it a really smooth taste. I would definitely order these again, and I hope you will too. Usual Wines are made from world-class AVAs, American Viticultural Area in California, like Napa, Sonoma, and Santa Barbara, and are made with minimal intervention, zero sugar, and zero additives. We have a special holiday product coming early November, Usual Reserve. It's an ultra-premium, limited-edition Mount Veeder Cabernet Sauvignon. Introducing Usual Reserve. This is our most special wine yet, just in time for the holidays. Hailing from one of the most celebrated plots of land in all of Napa, this Cabernet Sauvignon is concentrated and rich with just enough grip. Gift it to someone special or keep it all for yourself. The holidays, as usual. Go check out their website at www.usualwines.com and use our discount code MUSES for $8 off your first order and try your first glass on us. That's www.usualwines.com and use our discount code MUSES, M-U-S-E-S, for $8 off your first order. Enjoy!
I love the natural progression of your guys' career from doing these zines for fun and then starting Norton Records and then starting Kix books. And you've got a bunch of great books on Kix, and this new one, Mind Over Matter, all about Fortune Records, is just incredible.
Oh, thank you.
So much fun reading it. I expected to learn about Fortune Records, but I came out with so much more, like learning about Jack and Devorah, their journey with the label, learning about all these different artists spanning so many different genres.
Yeah.
It was so much fun reading and then looking them up and listening to the music that they were talking about and discovering all these new songs
right.
that are in my rotation now. And I learned a lot about the era as well. And like you said, to top it off, there's just countless photos of memorabilia and the color photos and everything. It enriched it so much. And when I was reading it, it was like an encyclopedia of that whole scene. It's incredible the amount of detail that he found out and put in there. And it's all fun and interesting to read. It's not like, oh, it's like a heavy, big book. Like you look at it and you're like, oh my God, I can't wait to dive into this. And yeah. you're just flying through it because it's so fascinating. Like everything about it was just how long, like what began your fascination with Fortune? And when did that spark where he decided like, I want to bring their story to light?
Well, I was discussing with this with Mike a couple of weeks ago, and he seems to nail it down to one point, which was probably a dozen years ago, maybe longer. He said that we were all hanging out. He was visiting us, and we were all hanging out and talking about Fortune, this and that. And he said that I had said to them, you guys should just do the book. You know, why don't you just write a book? You know so much about it. And you're so obsessed with it. And he said that that was where the idea came from. I remember, and I actually found a carbon of it because, I'm kind of a collector maniac in every regard and kind of a record keeper. A lot of that was destroyed in Sandy, but I found a carbon of a letter that I had written to Devorah almost 30 years ago, asking her for an autographed picture, because I thought it was incredible that, she as a woman had created a record label like this. And everyone knows that, you call it Jack and Devorah. It's Devorah and Jack.
Nice.
You know, it's, she's really the one. She was a songwriter. She was very maternal with many of the acts that came through there, many of them hard up for possibly money or food or just a little advice. She was really, from what I understand, I never knew her apart from speaking with her on the phone, but she seemed like an incredible character, and I really wanted to get that autographed picture. And I didn't even think of it. You know, I didn't think about like, well, I'm asking about this, you know, about this woman that we would end up doing a book about her label, her label, Jack's label, but it was her label. And it's an amazing thing how like a thought that happens years before can actually culminate into being, you know, possibly at least at this point, the last word in Fortune Records. You know, hopefully, and I know this already, there's people coming out of the woodwork saying, oh, you know, I was at Fortune Records. This one guy called asking like 2 days after he ordered it. He's like, I need a tracking number. It's like, okay, well, you know, we haven't gotten the book from the printer yet, but as soon as we have a tracking number, we'll send it to you. And he sounded older. And I said, were you a Fortune fan back in the day? And he said, oh yes. You know, 1953, I was buying records in Lansing, Michigan, and so on. And he said that he had been in the studio as a onlooker when Nolan Strong recorded Adios, My Desert Rose. And how did that happen? He said, I went to school with Nolan's brother. And he said one day, let's go down to Fortune. And they happened to be recording. So, you know, on that note, and I'm sure anybody who ever publishes a book, you know, there's going to be people who come up later and you go, dang, I wish I had that story for the book. We could have added that. But there's a lot of that. And many, many people who are Fortune fans, Fortune collectors, because it's really a collector. Paradise, that label, have come up and said, oh, well, you know, here's this tidbit and that tidbit. It's never detail about the records to date. Any improvement on the discographical data that's in the book, but memories about seeing an artist or of some hilarity that happened, and something amusing or heartfelt or heartbreaking that happened. This is what a book does, you know. It brings people around it and makes them remember and makes them think and makes them reconsider that, hey, look, there's this label I had a five records from it, but holy cow, you know, they had all these records. They had hillbilly acts, they had gypsy acts, you know.
They had like everything.
Instrumental, yeah, I mean, they had everything. So that was, you know, that's the pleasure in being able to put out a book and then have people respond to it, you know, even when it's like, oh, you know, I wish we would have had you, but how would we ever have found somebody who was just another person who bought records and happened to go by the store?
It's amazing the amount that you guys did get to put in there, and there's so much material there. So yeah, it's certainly not lacking in any way, yeah, even without them. And that's cool that people are now going to discover the book and remember their memories and hopefully kind of share them and put them out in the world as well.
Well, that's it. You have the people like him who was there and has his own experience with it, and then he gets to relive it.
Yeah.
And then people like us who could only wish that we would have been able to experience it, but we can't. And that's why we get so much true joy out of reading. We're huge into reading as well. Mm-hmm. We get to transport ourselves back into this time. Mm-hmm. And then we get to speak to people like you who are just kind of making it all happen. We live for these kinds of stories. And I'm having so much fun listening to you speak.
Well, one thing about that just came to mind is that, you know, Fortune was an underdog. You know, Motown was the label, came along a little bit later and ended up being, you know, the well-known label where they were not. And to their credit, to Fortune's credit, there's not a loser in the batch. I mean, it's remarkable that every record offers so much and in a different perspective and was recorded under the most primitive conditions, often with one microphone in a room that that's often described as like a garage or a dungeon, I even heard, you know, that it was very primitive. It wasn't like a professional recording studio or even like Sun. You know, Sun was, you know, it was a small studio, but still the equipment was top notch. There was great microphones. Sam Phillips was a genius with that regard and tied in with radio stations and the tile floor. It was refracted the sound a certain way. Not Fortune. It was the incredible talent and really the magic of what was in that back room of a little record store that created all of these amazing, amazing records. It was important, and Mike was excellent at this too, in Billy's wish to draw a portrait of the label within the city of Detroit. And that's why we have the end papers are, you know, two different eras of the street maps of Detroit, because Detroit went through, you know, being automotive capital of the world, possibly at one point in time, the Motor City, to going through really, really rough times. And still today is a far way from getting back to where it ever was. And will it ever? We don't know. I knew one detail that as a publisher, I wanted very badly, because all of my books have been printed in the United States. And I felt really strongly about that because, you know, as a publishing company, Kix Books is in the States. And I like to be able to have the control over being able to see the printing, and everything had been done here in New York State. So I got to see stuff coming off the press and approve it and so on. That was really important. But with this book, I wanted it printed in Detroit. And everybody I talked to, and I have friends in the publishing industry who said, you can't print a 560-page hardcover, full-color book in the United States and have that fly. It's going to be impossible for you, way too expensive. You can print for a lot less overseas. And I said, I you know, we can't do that. We have to give the work to Michigan. We have to give the work to Detroit. And that's a real matter of pride for me, that I think people don't realize, you know, that it was printed in Detroit, USA. It's important to me. And as a person who spent a lot of time myself in Cleveland, which is very nearby Detroit, and I used to go to rock and roll shows in Detroit a lot, that whole Midwest kind of instinctive mentality of survival is something that I hope comes through in the book. That when you see it, people say like, "What's Fortune Records?" And I've had that happen. "What's Fortune Records?" It's like, open the book, you know, and they'll look at it and they'll go, "What is this? Why have I never heard of this record label?" And I think to myself, you know, first time that they hear a Fortune record, they're going to be mind blown, and it's going to it's going to be exciting for them in this world where there's everybody knows everything from the internet. Oh yeah, I know. You know, I know how to do this and I know about that. And it is great. I mean, the internet is great for that information, but the information that you're going to find in Mind Over Matter is not information that has been available elsewhere. Some things might be, of course, you know, with more well-known things, but it's such a eye-opener, and I know it is for many collectors and, of course, people who don't know anything about the label. Hopefully it'll get them involved with it, and I hope that it inspires other music lovers and record collectors to look at where their interest is focused, and can they start telling those secrets about or mysteries, divulging the mysteries of records that came out of their city or their community. And maybe those people are still around. You could go interview them. You better do it soon, you know, to get the earliest history that you possibly can. And don't trust a history that is available necessarily on the internet or in some other book that was written years before. You know, read it, consider it, and then do your own research. And that's the joy of it. The greatest joy is not having any information and starting on that hunt. And to this day, there's still several hunts for individuals who made records under fake names or wrote paperbacks under pseudonyms and trying to figure out who is this person and what was this tiny little company that published these four books and went under, or made one record and then they vanished. And that's the joy of it. That's really the joy of it, is the story behind an artist and a record label. And the record label thing is near and dear to me, and was very near and dear to Billy, also to Mike and Lenny Kay, who wrote the brilliant foreword to the book, is that the label is the vehicle that this music is served up. And a talented person could go into a record label or go in with a producer, and that producer could tell them what to do. You know, sing this way, you know, do this, do that, change the words, whatever, and I'll get you people to back you up. And it's not the immediate dream of somebody walking in off the street with a gang of friends and recording. And the fact that 99% of those records were recorded in one situation, in that one place that was never really improved. So for decades, that sound, just like at Sun, it's a recognizable sound. You know what a Sun record sounds like. You know what a Chess record sounds like. You also absolutely know what a Fortune record sounds like. There is it's so distinctive that even in playing doo-wop records, which I do all the time, you know, you hear different records. You may not be able to identify the studio. Sometimes you can, but with Fortune, it's like from the very first note, it's like, that's a Fortune record. And it's not that it's any weirder. It's that there is an absolute, almost supernatural thing that comes off of the grooves of that record and just blows your mind.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened when I read the book. I didn't know anything about Fortune Records. I went in just blind, and it was just like such a discovery. And it is just so great, not only discovering all this amazing new music, but learning the story behind it. And each one of those people who recorded there have their own story. And yeah, you kind of get into that as well. And they're all fascinating. And I learned so much about Detroit in that era as well through the book. And it's just so well-rounded. And it really, like, I felt like I was there. Like, it put me there. And it's such a magical experience.
Thank you. Thank you for everything that you do and who you are. You're so inspiring. You do so much. You're creative.
Well,
you're a musician.
I don't know about
you're a historian.
That.
You
yes.
are.
What else? Keep going.
Oh, like, yeah, and we're going to use this for our intro. I'm so energized by this conversation that I'm going to have to go run or jog out some energy or something. Like, if this wasn't my podcast, I would be very excited to listen to this.
Okay.
I live in the country.
Oh, lucky girl.
Well, we've been speaking for about an hour now. We could surely talk to you for hours more, but we won't keep you too much longer. Lynx, is there anything else that you feel like we haven't missed out on? Or Miriam, is there anything that we haven't mentioned that you would like to talk about before we start wrapping it up and saying our goodbyes?
Not really. It's, you know, I'm still, I'm working working really hard at a couple of record projects. I can't announce them at this point in time. And also another book project that I can tell you that it does involve photographs from the 50s and 60s that have been unseen before that involve teenage gangs. I'm working on that. So that kind of comes out of the Bad Seed thing also. You know, working on the new Kix magazine, Kix number 8, focusing pretty much on exactly what the old issues did, radio, unknown rock and roll stories, you know, some mysteries in there, and also the humor, and filling in a lot of things that have happened in the past 28 years, new information that has come up from some of the people who became kind of Kix icons from days gone by, and Norton icons, because we were so interested in finding these people and eventually recording them on Norton. So working on that, and then also working on trying to really kind of inflame people about vocal group music. And I do that with Mark Miller. We're both vocal group fanatics, and try to deliver vocal group music from the original era that is unknown and mix it up with things that are known so that people aren't completely wigged out about what the hell's going on here and get into it. You know, the whole idea is to reel people into what you love because you want other people to be excited too. And when they're excited, things happen. Other records turn up. People start to talk about things. And this whole isolation deal, like, I don't know how it is for you, but I live in an apartment in Brooklyn. And for the past 7 months, I've been virtually alone here, and I've gone through panicky periods like everybody else, and very depressed periods. But the thing that keeps you going, and I've had repeated information from phone callers, from people like collectors who are saying, "What are you listening to?" You know, and I said, "Well, this is what I'm listening to this too." You know, and it's been that whole flow of music and work that has kept things going, and finishing this book over the summer, over the spring and summer, under these conditions was something else. I stopped to think about it. What if the world wasn't the way that it was? What if I wasn't trapped in here? What would have happened with it? Would it have been better, or would it have been somehow worse? You know, and all I can say is you have to work with what you have, you know, and when bad things happen, you just have to throw yourself into it and get into it. And through being into, I don't know what I'm saying. It's like, I don't want to get too philosophical, but what I mean is like work and creativity and making something out of bad times, making lemonade out of lemons, as they say, or whatever, or tough things when people say you can't do that, or it's not going to happen, this is a bad time for a book to come out, how are you going to get it distributed? It's the first Kix book that we never had a big opening party for, and reading and launch. It's the first time that hasn't happened. That'll have to happen next summer, hopefully, when things open up, you know, to be at least have a celebration of Detroit music. But I knew that this was the right time. We couldn't let it go any longer. That maybe in producing a book at the worst possible moment would be something that would elevate the lives of everybody concerned. And I believe that that is what's happening. People are, for one thing, they're a captive audience, right? Yeah. They're like, wow, where's the book? Where's the book? Here's the book. And then you don't hear from them for like 2 weeks. And then they come back with a, oh boy, you know, what happened to you? I was reading and listening to records. So that's what it's all about, is getting people excited and being excited, because life is short. And sitting around worrying about things is one thing, and taking that worry and making it into something beautiful is another.
It is a perfect quarantine book to just sit on your couch and, you know, yep, with a nice cup of tea and just devour it. And that's certainly what I did. It kept me company for a couple of weeks. And
thanks, Liz.
All of those songs did as well. And you mentioned earlier, and I've read a whole bunch of your blog. Would you ever consider turning that into a memoir?
Actually, yes. And it was an idea some time ago. And then these other projects, you know, I'm always interested in I think possibly it's a greedy thing of wanting to get into other people's lives. You know, I know my life, but other finding out about other people's lives and what they went through. And it's always a surprise, like how some record, like with Kim Fowley, like, you know, how did you make all of these records? And it's an amazing thing when a person is a real storyteller like him. But yeah, I have thought about that primarily because an odd thing has happened. I used to be a mad correspondent, okay, a pen pal, wrote to people all the time from the beginning of time, and I still kind of do. I still have some friends that like to put a pencil onto paper, and we write to each other. But back in those days, before the internet, and before you really could get on a phone and like chat for hours or whatever, you wrote letters. And of course, people overseas who were record fans, going to see bands and stuff like that, would write letters. And a lot of people have given me back the letters that I wrote to them. And it's hilarious. I mean, I've had like great fun times reading those letters because what was I thinking? And my sister found letters that I had written and so on. So those letters, the letters that I wrote are there, but also the letters that people wrote to me. And so, you know, not on the, you know, I know that, you know, some of the famous people that I have had a long correspondence with, it's not about the fact that they were famous or whatnot, but it's it fills in history at the time. Like, for instance, with the Cramps, you know, like while they were in New York and I was still in Ohio before the group, you know, I got loads of letters from individually written by Lux and Ivy that were about what was going on in New York. Could they help distribute the new Perubu 45, which they did? And, you know, it was an exchange. And you, in reading them, you see the development of this idea, of this plan, and this kind of idea with them, particularly, at least for me, because it was a personal relationship, is that they didn't know anything about forming a band either. They didn't know anything about it. You know, Ivy didn't really know how to play. He had never been on stage singing. The idea that, hey, you never played drums, you're the one for us. You know, and Brian, like, you know, trying to look cool, playing whatever he was doing, you know, it was like, that's not going to stop us because, you know, there's something that we got to do, and we got to do it now. We got to do it together. So, you know, that's where it really comes from. And so there's letters from them, and there's a really, really long letter that I read the other day from Lester Bangs that just goes on and on and on, single space, 7 pages of do it, do it, do it, like this encouragement kind of a letter. And he was my idol as a, you know, the rock writer that I had to, you know, read every word he ever did. And he was fantastic. So there's letters from him and lots of letters from other people, Cleveland people, New York people, people around the world, where it was a genuine exchange. Nobody was trying to make anybody else seem like they weren't smart. It was funny. It was raunchy sometimes. And I agree, you know, I think maybe the time is right. Maybe next year I'll do that, even though it might be a slim volume. And I don't really like to talk about, you know, personal stuff that much at all. You know, I'll talk about the fun stuff and about the superficial stuff. But, you know, as for the unhappy things and the things that might cause some grief to myself, particularly, I really care about my own mind, is eliminated. But I think that it would make it would fill in some details where people might think, whoa, well, these people were like artists who like sat down and wrote a, you know, some kind of a huge plan on how to, you know, dress and play and so on. Yeah. It wasn't like that. And the New York scene really wasn't a bunch of intellectuals hanging out. It wasn't. It was a bunch of people who didn't feel, at least us imports who came here, couldn't fit in. And even in Ohio, like everybody who could possibly leave Cleveland pretty much did. You know, because there wasn't a place to grow. There are many great, great groups that respond and lived and died there. They had a real limitation. In New York, you got to hang out all the time with people who felt the same way. They didn't feel comfortable really in fitting into the world as it was, or other people their own age. And it was comfortable that way, despite all of the, you know, crazy stories about this, that, the other thing of what went on. People were very genuine and you sought each other out. And I very quickly knew that I wasn't never going to leave New York. And even now, when a lot of friends are leaving and my brother's up in Canada, and he's encouraging me. Look, every morning I get a beautiful picture of him, you know, like on the lake with the woods and all this stuff. Come on over, you know, come here. And I'm like, but I can't leave. And he's like, why not? I don't know why not. You know, so many friends have left and it is really kind of getting to feel spooky and a little desolate, but it was spooky and desolate in 1976. It was bankrupt at that time. Nobody wanted to come to New York. It was like, New York, no way. They were, you could find an apartment for, you know, $150 for two people, easy, you know, and you could find a job because nobody wanted to stay here to work, you know? So if it's the same thing, I don't mind. I really don't mind. You know,
it's been always in transition.
Always, you know, and things go through their cycles as they do in Canada and Sudbury or Toronto, Montreal, wherever, and in every city, Detroit, Michigan, Cleveland, Ohio, all these different cities. New York, you know, we went through bad stuff, you know, on 9/11. A lot of people left at that time and we didn't know what was going to happen. Well, now it's happening again in a worldwide kind of a way. And yeah. New York suffers in a big way because it's a big city and a lot of people close to each other. And it's a little scary, but
hopefully,
it's home.
Yeah, hopefully there'll be a positive transition in the next 2 weeks. And
less than two. Okay. It's 9 days. What are you kidding? I'm counting.
Yes, let's hope by the time that this is released, there's been some good news in the world.
Yeah, exactly.
We can all rejoice.
I believe that there will be. Totally. You must believe and you've got to vote, right?
Yeah.
So that's
exactly.
That's the story.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, anytime. I had a pleasure. It was a pleasure. It was.
Well, it certainly was a pleasure. And we're going to continue to follow you and look for the other things that you're putting out.
Yeah, you got to come back and chat again.
Yeah, we love that. We have more to talk
about.
I'll
interview you guys next time, okay? Yeah. Tell me more about this Sudbury place. You know,
I don't know. I don't live there anymore.
Okay, well, I think that if we could, well, I don't want to say that. I was saying something about congratulating each other, but, you know, Sudbury had a lot of great things about it. It really, really did. It really did. Yeah. It was my bedrock, literally. And I grew up there the first almost 11 years of my life. And I owe it a lot. And I really feel, even though I've been here for, you know, all of my adult life, for sure, I still feel that Canadianness. And people often say that about me. They say that you're so Canadian. I'm not quite sure what they mean about that, if it's good or bad, but I like to think it's good.
I think it's good. I'm proud of where I came from too. Yes. And I think it makes the traveling experiences that we've had and the move to the big city sweeter because we had to make that choice and to make the moves and to take the risk. And we not there's anything wrong with just growing up there.
Yeah.
Thanks. But it was a big move.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly proud of where I come from and where I am now. And I'm sure you feel the same. But this was an absolute joy of a conversation. And I'm going to be really looking forward to putting it out. Thank you for taking the time to speaking with us. This is all so exciting.
Oh, thank you so much.
Muses is produced by Chantal Lemieux and Lynx O'Leary and is part of the Pantheon family of podcasts. Find all of our shows, notes, social, and links at pantheonpodcasts.com. All songs can be found wherever you get your music. Please download and purchase these great and important tracks. Come find us at Pantheon Podcasts on Facebook, tweet us at Pantheon Pods, or see us at R&R Archaeology on Instagram.
Attention, fans of fairy tales that are magical, hilarious, and grim. The award-winning Pinna original podcast, Grim, Grimmer, Grimmest, has new episodes out now. While you've probably heard of the Brothers Grimm, you've never heard these tales told in quite this way. I'm Adam Gidwitz, best-selling and Newbery Honor author of books for children, and in Grimm, Grimmer, Grimmest, I share the real, weird, grim fairy tales with real, weird, hilarious kids. In each episode, you not only get to hear a story, but you also get to enjoy this group guessing what'll happen next, cracking jokes, and sharing their own perspectives on the tales. Also, heckling me. They love to heckle me. The episodes are rated on a scale from grim to grimmer to grimmest, so there's always a great variety of tales to explore with your family. You can listen to Grim, Grimmer, Grimmest now wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to follow the show so you don't miss new episodes.